I love the way Booker T and the MGs open up this show every Saturday, huh? Makes me happy. I hope it does you, too. Good afternoon, everybody. Stan Turner with you here. Yeah, that would be the name of the show, too. Nice to have you on board here. And look who's on the other side of the glass with his hand all over the levers and the buttons and all that stuff in there, the ejection seat.
Who is it?
Tommy Shooby Dooby Dooby, the guy with whom I... Notice that grammar. With whom I do the All Request and Dedication program Monday through Friday. Well, you're supposed not to be here today. What brings you around besides your car and your legs?
Well, Kyle's wife wasn't going to a wedding, but then last minute she decided she was going to a wedding and her car broke down.
Okay.
So Kyle is taking her out there the day.
Well,
no worries. I enjoy being here.
I'm not too worried, Tom.
I know you're deeply moved.
I am.
Deeply
upset. Very nice to have you here as usual. We click just like, I do with Kyle and you and I. We know what's going on here, or so we would like to.
I agree, yeah.
Now, come on now. Let's go easy on me. Well, Tom, our all-request show, yesterday especially, we had a slew of birthday dedications, didn't we? My gosh,
that was
one
ridiculous.
Guy had about, one guy alone had five or six dedications, including ones from people in Hawaii. In California, and birthdays
Egan.
All over the landscape, huh? Yeah, how about
they were from everywhere.
They
I've never
were,
seen anything
were.
Like that. Almost every song was a dedication.
It was, and interesting to note that today there are more birthdays out there. A little birdie has given me to understand that a certain young lady by the name of Mary is celebrating a birthday today. A little music to go along with that.
Nothing's quite as pretty as Mary in the morning. When through a sleepy haze I see her lying there, soft as the rain that falls on summer flowers, warm as the sunlight shining on her.
Al Martino paints a pretty picture. There I have a pretty lady, I guess, by the name of Mary. I don't guess, I know. Happy birthday, MMB. And happy birthday to all of those of you celebrating another year today and tomorrow this weekend.
You're a big old softy.
I am.
I am
indeed. You're not a year older, you're just a year better. Right, Tombo?
That's what I keep telling people.
Hey, we have a show that's loaded with goodies today. We love history, and we're going to be doing a lot of things about that. Many of us have favorite teachers, maybe from grade school, middle school, high school perhaps, college or university. Maybe you have favorite teachers from all those stops along your educational journey. I know I do. Good teachers are invaluable and often greatly undervalued. Interesting to note that one of the greatest teachers is not a person at all, but something called history. If we pay attention to the lessons from what happened long ago or even yesterday, we can learn a lot. The triumphs and the mistakes of the past, what works and what doesn't. History, if we let it, can bring us a better future. Besides all that, history is fascinating. We all love stories, and history is all about stories. Stories of people, of those who came before us and who grappled with the challenges of their day. I keep what I call a In Case You Missed It file. It's a pile of stories, true stories, that I put aside for storytelling moments like today, like right now. And to give me a nimble-minded assist, we welcome back our good friend and regular guest, Brent Peterson. Brent heads the Washington County Historical Society. He's already patting himself on the back. Brent is a live wire, a real history dynamo when it comes to gathering, preserving, and telling the stories that shaped our today and our tomorrow. Brent, welcome back. Thank you, sir.
Wow. Well, thank you, Stan. Well put.
Well, thank you. Did you write that yourself?
I should have. I could be a ghostwriter.
Sounded like something you could have written,
yeah.
Or it wasn't. Well, Brent, before we dive into some stories here, boy, we've got some gems today, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Share with our listeners. Folks, you'll be glad you're on board here. Brent, you've been up to your earlobes, your historic earlobes in history this past week because St. Paul has been host to the American Association of State and Local History. This
absolutely.
Is a national organization. Of course, you fit right in there, yeah. And you've been a busy boy keeping late hours. I mean, in the best possible sense of that term, man.
With over 1,000 historians hitting St. Paul, the town was really shaking all the way into about 8:45.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't get out of a parking ramp.
I know. We were
because of all those people. That's fine.
It was just a fantastic conference. Actually, it's still going on. Today's the last day. Yeah. A lot of tours going on. A lot of morning sessions, I believe, but it has been just absolutely fantastic. The weather, of course, helps a lot, too.
Oh, yeah, it does. It's been perfect. There was a nice editorial in the St. Paul paper welcoming all the historians. Just briefly, what sort of things do they gather to talk about?
Well, we talk about preservation, of course. We talk about how to make our museums better, how to make them more accessible to the public. Access is always the key term for history because we collect this history. It's very important to collect it, but it's also very important to disseminate it, make sure that the public has access to it, tell the stories of the past so that the future can be a brighter place.
Well, stories, that's what it's all about.
Absolutely.
I think there's nothing wrong with saying history ought to be made entertaining, too.
Oh,
entertaining.
Yes.
I think I once taught over at St. Thomas University, and I knew that, yes, you had to impart the information about broadcast news writing, but you had to do kind of a little entertainment, a little tap dance
absolutely.
Out there, too. And that gets people in the tent, gets their attention, and pretty soon they don't realize that they're learning stuff.
That's
it's fun.
Absolutely. We have hands-on things at our museums. We have programs, just like across the state and across the country. And seeing what other people do, not only in Minnesota, but people from Texas, people from Kansas, people from Pennsylvania, seeing what they do and how we can relate it here in Minnesota is just absolutely fantastic.
Right. Brent, the theme of this program right here, we're going to be celebrating our 10th anniversary come October, late October. Been doing the show this long. You've made many appearances here, and thank you for that. It's all about storytelling. That's what I set out to do on this show. Is everybody does like a good story. There's no doubt about it. All you have to do is look at history, and you've got an unending, a bottomless well of great stories there. And you at you and your cohorts are going to be proving that very point come next Thursday here in Stillwater at the semi-annual membership meeting
of the
Washington County Historical Society, of which I'm a proud member. I think I'm paid up.
Yes, you are.
Yes,
yes.
I would know, wouldn't you?
I checked
before I came down here.
Right.
We got to get Tom Shooby-Doo in the society, too, don't you?
I got to imagine, if you weren't paid up, would there be like an army of historians with elbow patch jackets chasing after you?
And he'd leave the studio right now, too. Brent would walk out.
I would absolutely do that.
Okay. A big deal, though, coming next Thursday, not only will we have a fine meal and fellowship and all the rest, but you always put together a great program. You talk about history. You talk about stories. You know, history is fascinating. It's not always fun. There's obviously tragedies involved. We'll talk about one here in particular. What are we going to hear about Thursday night? This will be at the Water Street Inn.
The Water Street Inn, right next to the St. Croix River.
Okay.
And the tragedy, we learn from those tragedies. We learn what went wrong. We learn from them so it doesn't happen again. And unfortunately, back in the days of the steamboat, just great kings and queens floating down the St. Croix, the Mississippi River. They hauled logs. They were really the workhorse back at the time, but they also were the ones that people traveled on. And in 1890, out of Red Wing, there was a steamboat called the Sea Wing, and the Sea Wing was going on an excursion. And they got down to a place on the Mississippi River where they call what they call Lake Pepin. Lake Pepin is actually the Mississippi, but it widens so far out it looks like a big lake.
Big bulge in the
big
river.
Big bulge,
at Lake City there, right?
Exactly. And the Sea Wing got down there, and all of a sudden they didn't have radar, they didn't have Doppler and so forth. There was a big storm that came up, and something like the Lake Pepin could get very, very violent. The waves could get very high. The wind could come screaming down there, and they learned that the hard way as the Sea Wing. These riverboats were top-heavy because they wanted to get down, float in shallow waters, and the Sea Wing capsized. There were 225 passengers on board, and unfortunately, nearly 100 of them drowned in that disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And it came to a fact that they were bringing the bodies back. It was just terrible that Red Wing was known as city of the bodies or something like that. And one day, they had 44 funerals in Red Wing. So the book has been written and then rewritten, and now it's been updated by the author, Frederick Johnson. And Frederick is going to be coming to tell us all about the Sea Wing disaster. He's going to tell us what happened, why it happened, and how we learn from that experience so that it wouldn't happen again.
Let's give a little sample here. This I'm going to draw from a MinPost article written by Dick Bernard last month here, just to give you a little flavor. And Brent, you've given us a good overview. This tragedy happened on Lake Pepin near Lake City. On July 13th, 1890, the shallow and large wide spot in the Mississippi, as we said, below Red Wing. In the early evening of that day, July 13th, 1890, the overloaded small steamer Sea Wing capsized in very strong winds. 98 of the 215 passengers died. Most of them were from Red Wing. This was and remains one of the largest domestic maritime disasters in all of U.S. history, and one of the very few in which weather was the major causative factor. Many of the Sea Wing passengers were aboard a barge that was lashed to the Sea Wing. All but one of the passengers on the large barge survived. The Sea Wing, only 14 feet wide, imagine that, 14 feet wide, and about 100 feet long, was overloaded and no match for the wind-induced massive waves. The passengers hardly had a chance. In these days, and Brent, you pointed this out, in these days of AccuWeather and instantaneous forecasting, it's probably hard to imagine being surprised by that large of a bad weather system. People back then, though, relied on the usual visual signs of bad. In other words, looking up at the sky, and they knew what bad weather meant in general. But this storm was different. Not long before the Sea Wing was struck down, a huge tornado from the same weather system had hit the Lake Jervis area up here in the Twin Cities near north of St. Paul. But this was 1890, and there was no easy way to spread the word about what was lurking not far away. The boat, the Sea Wing, the captain, who survived, by the way, and the passengers hardly had a chance. Johnson, this man we're going to hear from Thursday night, Fred Johnson, first wrote about the Sea Wing in 1986. And at the time, he started planning to do an article, but there was so much material that he expanded his work into a book, as you said, Brent. Now we fast forward to this year, and major additions provided by newly discovered material, including from the descendants of the casualties and the survivors, gave rise to a much expanded new work. Now, indeed, even at the recent program, I think it was down in Hastings at the LaDuke Mansion where Mr. Johnson spoke, members of the audience showed photos of their ancestors who were with the Sea Wing that ill-fated day. And in this new edition, Fred Johnson painstakingly researched both those who died and those who survived. And judging from the audience on that recent Sunday night, the new volume will bring forward still more new information retained in those family collections for nearly 125 years. You see that all the time, don't
yes,
you, in your business. Yeah.
Actually, you would think that all history has been shuffled out with all the computers, with all the eBay, and people have looked through
everything's been discovered.
You got the American Pickers going, finding all the history. History comes out all the time, and it's just fascinating how we can interact and interlock some of what we have and what comes out, and it makes a great story and so forth.
I know, since we've now been talking about this, a lot of folks are saying, okay, who is this again? When is this? Can I come? May I come? Why don't you give us the basic information about what's happening next Thursday night here in Stillwater?
Well, the basic information is the event is at the Water Street Inn in Stillwater. It's on Thursday, September 25th. It starts, the social hour starts at 5:30. You all gather around, talk stories, talk shop. And then 6:30, we have a sit-down, beautiful, wonderful dinner, great food at the Water Street Inn. And then we have a brief meeting, a welcoming by the Board of Directors of the Washington County Historical Society. And then we move on to Fred Johnson, who will be presenting it after 7:30.
You'll keep the business meeting really short, won't you?
Oh, absolutely. We keep it really short because there are people in the audience who start throwing rolls and buns at me. And
let's get to the program.
And then it's it's very inexpensive. Only for members, it's only $20. Non-members, it's only $25. And you can become a member right there at that time.
Excellent. So there you have it, folks. Do yourself a favor and bring some friends, too. This is going to be an evening to remember. There's no doubt about it. History is not always about fun things, but this one, this is a tragedy that we need to remember. So, my experience, very few people know about this.
You're right.
And that's amazing considering the heavy loss of life.
Oh,
just amazing indeed. So, we'll fill you in through Fred Johnson and his book next Thursday night here. So, if you have any further questions, contact the Washington County Historical Society.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's do that. Let's take a break right now. It's 12:20 right now. What do we have? 70 degrees, looking for a high today, about 73. Have a good day going. Stay with us. Stan Turner here. We'll be right back.
1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.com.
We've been family-owned since 1922. And we still believe that it all starts with you.
Luxurious, distinctive, serene, sculpted. That's the 2014 Buick Verano from Stillwater Motors. And now, the Buick Verano is more affordable than ever. For a limited time, you can save up to $7,000 on the Verano. Or lease it for just $298 a month with a $1,500 down payment. It's the car that won't break the bank. The Verano features available heated leather seats, quiet tuning cabin technology, and premium safety technologies that include side blind zone alert and rear cross-traffic alert. Even better, the Buick Verano gets up to 32 miles per gallon. Find out more about Consumer Guide's 2014 Automotive Best Buy. The 2014 Buick Verano at Stillwater Motors, located at Highway 36 and Stillwater Boulevard. Right on the corner, right on the price, and online at stillwatermotors.com. Redun's family owned and operated since 1922.
Stillwater Motors, good people to know.
Here is good news from the Valley Bookseller in Stillwater. The Saturday Storytime Trolley will continue through September. This event includes a ride on the trolley with an author or storyteller, and your $5 registration includes a token to board the trolley, a discount of 20% off a children's book that day, and a snack after the ride. The trolley picks you up at the store. You do need a reservation, so call Valley Booksellers, 651-430-3385, to reserve your spot and book the Saturday you want. Valley Bookseller, great books, great people in Stillwater. We are back. Stan Turner with you here. Thank you so much for your company today. Beautiful day out there. And I think we have a beautiful day going on the inside here, too, because we have Brent Peterson, the top banana, at the Washington County Historical Society. Had a good summer with the society?
Huh? It's been fantastic. I just love it.
And you play vintage baseball. You play. You belong to a team. You guys dress up in 1860 uniforms, play by the rules of 1860.
Yep. We have 38 rules. We interpret them differently.
And you break all of them.
Yeah, we try. And, you know, we are, I should, of course, mention this over and over again, that we are the reigning vintage baseball champions of Minnesota.
Well, they can fix anything.
Is that the Red Sox? Is that your team?
No, the Red Sox, they're in from Afton.
Oh, that's Afton. What's yours?
That's them. We're the St. Croix Baseball Club. Uh-huh. This is our 18th season. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Wow. We play Afton actually a week from tomorrow. Is our last game.
All right. Play Carver County tomorrow?
We play in Carver County down in Chanhassen High School.
Okay. Lots of luck to you, Brent.
Well, we're going to need it.
Thank you.
But
I know you'll need it. That's for sure. Say, there are good things going on at the St. Paul Depot right now. Going on through, I think it's 6 o'clock today. We're all about history today. Two screenings today at the St. Paul Depot. You know that one, the big depot, the historic depot in Lower Town. Two screenings of Back on Track. That's the rebirth of St. Paul's Union Depot. Greg Ellis's documentary about the extensive restoration of the historic building. And Bill Schrankler, who's been a guest on this show. Bill will be there, too. He'll talk about his book, Shadows of Time, Minnesota's Surviving Railroad Depots. Great book. And discuss images from the book that are on display at the depot's head house through October the 31st. Now, Schrankler says that his mother's journey as an orphan train rider sparked his lifelong love of trains and railroad history. In the late 19th century, early 20th century, 250,000 orphaned and homeless or unwanted children from New York City were shipped out to foster families in pioneer towns throughout the Midwest, including Minnesota. Also, John Deers, historian and author of St. Paul Union Depot, a great book, and we had John on the show, too. He will lead a tour of the building today. This is going on through 6 o'clock today. Free tickets are needed for the documentary screenings and the tour. You can go to facebook.com/Union Depot. And thank you to our buddy Marianne Grossman for the details on that. Isn't she great? Yeah. So, ha ha. You've been watching PBS, Brent?
I have. I am a PBS junkie.
And the Roosevelts and intimate history?
I think I'm going to go move to Hyde Park, I think.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it's just wonderful.
What are your impressions so far?
So far, I haven't watched all of it, but it's what I've seen of Teddy and FDR's childhood, it's just been amazing. What amazes me is all the, not only the still photographs, but the movies.
Yes.
The movies of Theodore Roosevelt and early Franklin Roosevelt are just impressive. Right. I don't know where they all came from, but... You know, Ken Burns can find everything and anything.
And he does. I'd like to read part of a review from Hank Stuber of the Washington Post and see if you agree. I think you will. A lot of you will who have seen this. It's called The Roosevelts in Intimate History. And this is what Stuber of the Washington Post has to say in part. The Roosevelts, the name of the documentary, probably have you hooked in a way that Ken Burns and his collaborators have not quite achieved since 2007's The War. That was about World War II. Unlike the intimidating climb offered by National Parks or Prohibition, two other documentaries by Burns, you easily glide through the Roosevelts' sublimely constructed narrative arc. The series is among Burns' best works. Thoroughly invested, the reviewer, Hank Stuber, says, I teared up every time one of the Roosevelts passed. When Theodore died in his sleep in January 1919, still entertaining a fantasy of a political comeback. When an ailing Franklin suffered a brain hemorrhage at his Warm Springs, Georgia retreat in April 45. And finally, when Eleanor, the best of the bunch, died peacefully in her bed in November 1962. I was also moved when they lost children, friends, and parents. The Roosevelts delivers on its subtitle, drawing such a full and close portrait of the extended clan and their social and political circles that a viewer cannot help but feel connected to them. Faults and all. Yeah. You find that sensational too, Brent?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
He goes on to say the Roosevelts also leaves a viewer with another, and I think this is important, leaves a viewer with another more subtle kind of grief, a sense of loss about the world the Roosevelts inhabited and the country they helped sustain. It can't be a mistake that Burns' saga, straddling the century from Teddy's birth to Eleanor's death, provokes a sense of wonder about how, in the Roosevelts' time, the United States outgrew a few of its inherent dysfunctions and managed to face its most dire crises. The series is airing just as the country, our country, seems least concerned about the common man, the fair shake in our shared well-being. We're looking back at FDR while all that beautiful New Deal infrastructure now begs for upkeep. We're looking back at Teddy while our magnificent West bakes dry in a sullied environment. And the Washington Post's Hank Stuber goes on, when you last you turn the television off and return to the present, it's tempting to wallow in embarrassment over how little our political leaders of either party accomplish now, how pathetic the whole game has become, the sorry ways in which we measure success. None of this is presented as such by the fastidiously objective Burns or the elegant and simple narration of the series, read by Peter Coyote and written by a great documentary writer, Jeffrey Ward. Isn't he something?
Yes.
Yeah, he's the best. You just get there all on your own. So he goes on, and this is a gush, but it's worth gushing about, isn't it? This is terrific. Any other thoughts about this?
Well, it's a time in our history that we should actually look back on and see where leaders were leaders. I mean, these people had all the money in the world. They didn't have to do what they did.
Exactly.
And yet they came down to the rawest part of the American society and helped build it up. And they didn't have to do it. They did it.
You're absolutely right. There was a sense this term noblesse oblige. Those who are given much must give much.
Right.
Okay? And they felt that. They lived that. One more thing from this Washington Post review, and you alluded to this. During one of his fireside chat radio broadcasts at the outset of World War II, FDR asked listeners to get a map and follow along as he explained both the Pacific and the European theaters to them, the people of the United States. What happened? The people went out and bought maps. they did follow along. They listened to their president, and by and large, they trusted him. By 1941, they'd already bought into and benefited from his New Deal, and the broadcast was not followed by a news cycle of contrary analysis and fact-checking of the president's every word. In the present context, it's hard to imagine that sort of devotion.
Right.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
How times have changed, and not necessarily for the better. Tonight is the final episode of The Roosevelts. Mm-hmm. It'll be a two-hour installment, as I believe it premiered last Sunday night.
Yes.
On PBS. So there you go. If you want your history in a way that you will not forget, and you will find yourself enriched by watching this, that's the place to be tonight. What else do you have on the play? What's going on?
Well, you just we have so much going on. It's unbelievable. We touched on our vintage baseball, but we also have a great event going on up at the Hay Lake School tomorrow at 2 o'clock. It's free to the public. It is the director of the Stonehouse Museum, Mary Smith, who is going to present on the importance of artifacts and primary sources. What does the artifacts tell us? Is it just, you know, a tape dispenser, or was this on someone's desk who used it at this and this?
You do this all the time.
Oh, it is.
The provenance, is that it?
Absolutely.
That fancy word saying, you know, what is the true background of this article?
What are the stories of the
artifacts?
And we get back to the same thing that we talked about earlier. I mean, why do we collect what we collect? Because it's a tangible item to help us tell the story. And Mary's going to tell us some stories. She is the director of the Stonehouse Museum, which is up in Marina on St. Croix, a great little town hall up there. If you've never been there, it is fantastic. It is at 2 o'clock at the Hay Lake School.
Okay, so Hay Lake School. That's one.
And then,
yes.
If that wasn't enough.
That's not enough. I
we
want
have
more.
On Monday, we have a kind of a segue from Hay Lake to a gentleman named John Christow. John is a author, a writer, and he has recently written a book called The Incident at the Otterville Station, a Civil War story of slavery and rescue. Now, John took the story that the 9th Minnesota Regiment ended up intervening with a slave owner out of Missouri who was trying to ship his slaves from his home in Missouri to Kentucky to sell just after the victory at Gettysburg by the Union Army. The against orders, the 9th Minnesota intervened, freed the slaves, and they were condemned for it, and they were actually going to be imprisoned, I guess. But John will have more information on that on Monday at the Warden's House at 7 p.m. Again, another free program of the Washington County Historical Society. And what I say about a segue from Hay Lake School to John Christow, up at Hay Lake School we have a log house. It's a Johannes Erickson log house built in 1868. It's on the National Register of Historic Places. John's mother's name was Alice Erickson Christow, who was also an author, but she was a direct descendant of Johannes Erickson. So John is going back to his family home up here in the Midwest. I think he lives down south now, but he's coming to the Warden's House at 7 o'clock on Monday at to talk about his book, and books will be there for sale.
Amazing, these connections.
Huh? Oh, isn't it great?
We're
I just love history.
Somehow. We have another one here. This is not connected to your historical society, but it is of historical interest, and it's here in the States, so we all do care about it. I want to read for you here a story that appeared in the Minneapolis Star Tribune in August, late August, and this caught my attention right away. I think it was on the front page. The headline reads, "On a Quest, Family Finds Their Hero. Hunt for Portrait of World War II Gunner from Brainerd Ends at the Pentagon." This is a great story written by Mark Brunswick, a staff writer for the Star Tribune. And here we go. This is quite a story, so stay with me. It's not that long, but it's very riveting. Even though he did not talk about World War II much, the family of Ray Shellen knew of his exploits as a heroic ball turret gunner. I should explain that a ball turret was just like it sounds. It was a cylinder-shaped turret that hung beneath B-17s and B-24s. Usually little guys had to crawl in there, and they had to fire 50 caliber machine guns, one on each side of their head, you know, at the enemy planes coming at them. It was a horrendous job. So a heroic ball turret gunner. This family also knew, the family of Roy Shellen also knew that famed artist Charles Baskerville had painted a portrait of the young Shellen, and they had a copy of the painting at their Brainerd home, just a copy. But until last week, this would have been in August, they had never been able to see the actual portrait. A few years ago, Shellen, the veteran, had actually made a pilgrimage to Washington in search of the painting, but looked in the wrong place and went away disappointed, and sadly he died in 2012. His daughter was undaunted and recently contacted Senator Al Franken's office after researching information about Baskerville, the artist. The Pentagon was quick to locate the portrait and arrange a viewing in a portion of the building, the Pentagon, not usually accessible to the public, where it has hung for decades. The Minnesota veteran was a war hero, and it was an honor to help ensure his family could view the portrait honoring his service, said Franken. Shellen's daughter, Carolee Bjorkness, went to Washington with her 13-year-old grandson in August to see the portrait hanging where it has been for decades. Quote, "It was just amazing to see his image hanging there in the building. It definitely was a memorable experience and one I will never forget," she said. The daughter wasn't aware that any portrait might actually exist until 10 or 15 years ago when her father first talked to her about it. The family thought the portrait might be at the Smithsonian and tried to find it when she drove her mother and father to Washington to see the National World War II Memorial. Although he became active in the Brainerd VFW after returning home from the war, Shellen never talked much about his wartime experience in Europe. And although he became active, as I said, he was a very proud man and proud of his country, but he didn't talk a lot about it, according to his daughter. Now, no one in the family doubts that the young flyboy in that portrait, who cuts a strong figure with the tail of a B-17 in the background. He flew 13 missions in B-17s as a member of the U.S. Army Air Force. On July 14, 1943, a 20-millimeter shell shot away half the ball turret, wounding Shellen and rendering his right arm useless. With his left arm, he continued to operate the turret and both 50-caliber guns and shot down two enemy fighters as his bomber limped home to England. He was presented the Distinguished Service Cross. That's just about one notch below the Medal of Honor, and a Purple Heart for his wounds, among other awards. It was never clear how Shellen came to sit for the famed portraitist, Charles Baskerville, but Baskerville, whose subjects would include the actress Helen Hayes, the Duchess of Windsor, and the King of Nepal, was designated the official portrait painter of the Army Air Forces in World War II. And he traveled to different war theaters to create more than 60 likenesses of officers and enlisted men that are now on permanent exhibit at the Pentagon. Shellen's widow, Lucille, did not make the trip to Washington recently, but thought her husband would have liked it. He would have liked to have seen the portrait. Quote, "He appreciated it, but he never really made anybody feel like they shouldn't have a portrait of themselves, too. He didn't brag about the painting. There were many people in Brainerd who didn't even know about the painting. They didn't know about him being shot up either." When the National World War II Memorial opened to the public in 2004, Shellen told the Brainerd Dispatch that it was important to speak truthfully about the horrors of war, but that he did not feel the need to single-handedly educate people about World War II. I love this part, mm-hmm. Brent Peterson. He said, Shellen said, this war veteran, "History is pretty much there if you want to listen."
That's right.
What do you think?
Excellent. What a great quest. I mean, it's terrible that he passed away before they could find it. But that is just a wonderful
story.
Absolutely.
Our thanks to the Star Tribune and reporter Mark Brunswick for a marvelous story. That's one to keep, huh? That was in my file of stories. I've been eager to get. I thought this would be the right time to do it. By the way, another World War II connection here. In the paper today, a collection of letters John F. Kennedy sent to the family of a lost PT-109 crewmate sold for $200,000 at auction. RR Auction, that's a Boston-based auction house, said the letters were to the family of Harold Marnie, who was killed in 1943 when the PT-109 boat Kennedy commanded was destroyed by the Japanese. Kennedy, who became a war hero for saving his crew members after that sinking, sent condolences to Marnie's parents, calling his death a great loss.
Oh.
So, history
is just...
It's just this morning. It's just right now, isn't
you,
it?
You keep finding these everywhere. Things. As I said before, they keep coming up, and you're never going to find everything, but it's going to pop up every now and then, and hopefully Ken Burns will be able to be there and help tell the story.
Go ahead. Nobody tells it better.
I love it.
Well, you do it too there, my friend. Brent Peterson, the executive director of the Washington County Historical Society, our guest. We're talking all kinds of history. Interesting, fascinating history. When we come back after the break, we're going to take you back to a catastrophe in 1937 at Lakehurst, New Jersey, and bring you up to date on the Hindenburg disaster. Yes, something recently happened that's tied to that one from way long ago. So stay with us here. Stan Turner here. We'll be right back. Bookseller invites you to the store on Sunday, October the 12th at 2 p.m. for the In-Store Book Club. We will be discussing the classic Truman Capote book, In Cold Blood. Set in Kansas, the book is an accounting of the two young men who robbed and murdered a Kansas family. It was among Capote's first major novels. Join us on Sunday, October the 12th at 2 p.m. Call 651-430-3385. Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. Located at 217 Main Street North in Stillwater.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barbershop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
Let the good times roll at Mississippi Dunes. Not only can you experience one of the most beautiful Lynx golf courses in the country, but Mississippi Dunes is so much more. Did you know that Mississippi Dunes can host your wedding in an elegant outdoor setting next to the Mississippi River? Or that Chef Jeffrey makes Doc's Landing a superior dining experience? Or that Mississippi Dunes is a destination of choice for rehearsal dinners, graduation, or retirement parties? Mississippi Dunes. Book a tee time and let the good times roll at MississippiDunes.com.
Another virus?
Relax. At Computer Repair and Services, every repair costs $99.95 and nothing more. Whether we spend 1 hour or 3 days, repairing your PC is always $99.95. I'm Joe Gillette. Visit Computer Repair and Services at 1441 Stillwater Boulevard or call us at 651-439-7544. It's just $99.95 for every PC repair, excluding hardware. At Computer Repair and Services, you can afford to fix your PC.
And we'll jump right back in here. The time's a-flying here. Stan Turner with you. Thank you so much for your company. We hope that we are delivering stories to you today. These are true stories that pique your interest.
Huh? Absolutely.
Brent Peterson, executive director of the Washington County Historical Society, is with us. Brent, we talked about St. Paul Depot having kind of an open house and some good things going on. So does St. Paul Downtown Airport, Holman Field, right across from downtown. They have an open house running through 3 o'clock this afternoon. Mm-hmm. You can tour that place. A lot of history there.
Oh, good heavens,
named
yes.
after Speed Holman,
yep.
who was a barnstormer, aviator, mm-hmm. back in the day, about the 20s and 30s. Yeah. One of the first pilots for Northwest Airways that became Northwest Airlines. And let's see, what else? Oh, during World War II at downtown St. Paul Downtown Airport, the military outfitted or fitted B-24 bombers with special kinds of navigation gear there. So we were very much on the map.
Oh, yes. Here.
So there are some photographs. You've probably seen them.
I have.
B-24s taken off and with the St. Paul skyline. Rather changed these days
yes,
from what it was.
Yes, it has.
More history to tell you about. Here's another story from my In Case You Missed It file, Brent, and I think this will grab your attention, too. The headline reads, this Washington Post again, Werner Franz, F-R-A-N-Z, last survivor of the 1937 Hindenburg crash, dies at age 92. Here's some history for you. Let's go back with this one, Brent. In 1936 and 37, young Werner Franz worked as a cabin boy on the Hindenburg, the largest, fastest, and sleekest mode of transportation the world had seen up to that time. The German-built airship, which was 804 feet long and kept aloft by hydrogen gas, was an engineering marvel capable of making the journey from Frankfurt, Germany to the U.S. in a mere 3 days. It was also a powerful propaganda tool of the Nazi regime. Mr. Franz, who was 14 at the time, washed dishes and delivered coffee to the crew of the Hindenburg. But in 2004, he described his 7 months with the Hindenburg as the best time of my life. The airship built by the Zeppelin Company made 34 successful Atlantic crossings in 1936 and was considered the height of luxury and speed in commercial aviation. But the era of the airship came to a ghastly end on May 6, 1937. When the Hindenburg burst into flames, it was attempting to land at a naval station at Lakehurst, New Jersey. Now, a guy named Herbert Herb Morrison was an American radio reporter, and he and his engineer, Charlie Nelson, had been assigned by station WLS in Chicago to cover that arrival, the arrival of the Hindenburg in New Jersey, for delayed broadcast. Morrison's description began routinely, but changed instantly. Here's how it went.
It's starting to rain again. The rain had cracked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It burst into flames. Get it started. It's rising terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks believe that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's like 20... Oh, 400 or 500 feet into the sky.
One of the more riveting, if not the most riveting, on-the-scene broadcasts ever. And that was recorded. By the way, radio network policy in those days, 1937, forbade the use of recorded material except for sound effects or dramas. Now, Morrison and Nielsen, as engineers, had no facilities for live broadcast that day. So what you heard there was, in fact, a recording. The 16-inch green lacquered disc, they were rushed back to Chicago by airplane that day and broadcast in full later that night. Portions were rebroadcast nationally by the NBC radio network, and they are now a part of history. Yes. It's amazing, Brent. More to the story about this man, Werner Franz, the last survivor of the Hindenburg. Within seconds, you heard there, the mighty aircraft, the Hindenburg, reduced to a smoldering metal skeleton, killed 35 of the 97 people on board, plus another person on the ground. It was the first major air disaster on American soil, made more vivid by the newsreel cameras, the press photographers, and of course, Herbert Morrison's description there on the scene. Now, somehow, Mr. Franz managed to escape, leaping to the ground from an opening in the bottom of the burning airship. He was the last surviving crew member of the Hindenburg when he died this past August 13th at his home in Frankfurt. He was 92. Mr. Franz was born in 1922 in Frankfurt. He needed to find a job to help out his family after his father became ill and had to quit his job as a hotel switchboard operator. Through his older brother, he learned of an opening on the Hindenburg. He made his first flight, a transatlantic voyage to Rio de Janeiro, in October of 36. 2 months earlier, the Hindenburg had impressed spectators at the Olympic Games in Berlin as it flew over the stadium with Adolf Hitler in the stands. A polished silver ship in the sky, Nazi swastikas were emblazoned on the tail of the Hindenburg in red, black, and white. The Hindenburg was longer than the U.S. Capitol, end to end, and 250 feet longer than the height of the Washington Monument. It was 130 feet high. Except for a sister Zeppelin that never saw commercial service, there has never been a larger passenger aircraft of any kind. In August 36, it made its latest crossing, going from Lakehurst to Frankfurt in 43 hours, 2 minutes. It was twice as fast as the fastest transatlantic ship, according to Dan Grossman, an Atlantic-based airship historian. It was definitely the Concorde of its time. Now, to finish up the story here, in June 36, German boxer Max Schmeling flew on the Hindenburg from the U.S. to Frankfurt after he defeated U.S. heavyweight champ Joe Louis. Schmeling was originally scheduled to fly to the United States in May of 37, but canceled his plans and came by ocean liner instead. Had he not, he would have been on the ill-fated voyage of the Hindenburg. There were 36 passengers, 61 crew members aboard when the Hindenburg reached the U.S. on May 6th. It circled Manhattan and flew over parts of New Jersey at its usual cruising altitude of about 650 feet before coming into land at Lakehurst. At 7:25 p.m., with the tail of the aircraft unusually low, Flames broke out in the rear of the airship. Leaking hydrogen was ignited by an electromagnetic spark. And within seconds, the linen membrane of the airship was engulfed in flames, as you heard Morrison describe. Mr. Franz was clearing tables in the officers' mess, with the nose of the aircraft pointing up. Dishes and silverware began to clatter on the floor, and he was drenched by a ruptured ballast tank filled with water. As the Hindenburg began to sink closer to the ground, Mr. Franz kicked open a hatch used to load provisions into the craft. He jumped out a few feet above the ground and ran. He can be seen in newsreel footage of the disaster. That's the guy right there. Mr. Franz ran in the direction of the wind, keeping the fire behind him. He escaped with no injuries or burns and was one of the few survivors who were in the belly of the airship. The next day, Mr. Franz returned to the site of the crash and walked through the wreckage to the spot where his bunk had been. There, he found a pocket watch that had been given to him by his grandfather. During World War II, Mr. Franz was a radio operator for the German Luftwaffe and later repaired precision machines for the German post office. He also worked as a figure skating and roller skating coach. A week after the crash in 1937, Mr. Franz testified before a U.S. Board of Inquiry about the Hindenburg. And get this, when he saw an officer of the German Air Ministry, he asked, "When the next Zeppelin is ready, may I fly again with her?"
Oh,
isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think any Zeppelins were flying from then on.
I don't think
Hitler,
so either.
Hitler had Germany by the throat and a good part of the world by the throat, too, after that. Yeah. Isn't that an amazing story?
It is just... It brings this story back to, you know, basically back to life. It telling his story after he passed away.
It tells you about the culture of the time, doesn't it?
Too? It does.
And even the history of broadcasting. Tom Shue, what about Morrison? There he is. It's not live. It sounds like he was not allowed to do a live recording, or a live broadcast, actually. But the emotion that he...
That's the one thing that really is shocking to me. I mean, if we saw something like this today, the closest thing I can imagine is the two towers. But he's, if you keep listening, he's about to cry watching this.
I think he is breaking down.
He is genuinely feeling the pain of the people that are going through this, which a lot of people today, I imagine, they would be sensationalizing it and not feeling it.
Yes.
I've always wondered, how do you sensationalize the innately sensational? It doesn't need to be sensationalized. Herbert Morrison allowed his emotions to show, and well, he should. You
genuine.
Or I, any of us, Brent, we would have. I mean, that is humanity dying before your very, very eyes. A totally unexpected disaster like that. But again, acknowledging the passing of the last survivor brings all of this back. And as I say, the tenor of the times, you kind of feel the history, how big that thing was, about transatlantic travel back then.
Less than a decade earlier, it was Lindbergh who made the first flight across the Atlantic, and now all of a sudden these Zeppelins are going back and forth and no problem,
no problem until 1937.
Exactly.
And of course,
it was just amazing how little that time frame was to get to this point.
It is. It's true. Brent, what else do you have on the
We should tell everybody that come October, that's the last month that both of our museums are open.
This is Washington County
Historical Society.
Okay.
So our museums up at Scandia, as we talked about, the Haylake School and Johannes Eriksson Log House, they're open until the last day is Sunday, October 26th. Mm-hmm. And the Warden's House remains open until the end of October, October 31st. Halloween is the last day. And last year we had the Johnsdale Paranormal Group come in to do and they're coming in again. They're going to do
Ghostbusters.
They are going to tonight. They're going through the Warden's House Museum, and then they're going to present at the end of October what they find. These people come with their heat-seeking rocket or cameras and their motion
detectors.
Imagers. And
I've seen that show.
Oh yes, but they're going to come back. And what's fun about these guys is they say, "We don't believe in ghosts." They say, "We don't believe in them, but
wink, 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 and a nod,
yes. But here's what we found. You try to explain it to me." And
that's an interesting
He's actually challenging the people to come and look at this and explain it to them. Right. And it's really a kind of a fun thing. They're going to be in for three different sessions at the Warden's House. We don't have the dates right now, but we'll get those out to the public.
The Warden's House is located on Main Street in Stillwater, and it's north end of town. It once upon a time was, in fact, the Warden's residence when Stillwater Prison was in what we now call Stillwater. Most of that facility is gone, the Warden House. And why do we call Stillwater Prison in Bayport Stillwater Prison?
Well, there's a big thing because a couple reasons. That's always a good question. We get that a lot. One, because the legislature demands that it's in Stillwater.
So it must be so.
It's
in Bayport.
And when the prison was built in 1914, 100 years ago, what was the name of Bayport?
Well, it was called South Stillwater.
So it was in Stillwater. South Stillwater, but it was still Stillwater, and that's why it's still called the Stillwater
part
Prison.
Part of the, quote, Stillwater, unquote, prison is in Oak Park Heights, and that's the maximum security facility.
Yes.
I'm guessing we have some listeners in there, too, and they know that facility all too well. It's built into the side of a hill.
I think it was one of the first ones that had a pod system underneath. Yeah. I was actually able to view that before it opened when I was in high school. They had public viewings, tours before it opened. I don't think you can do that now unless you do something really bad.
You're not going to take up residence here.
I don't think so. But
back to the Warden's House, Brent Peterson. You've done these Ghostbuster-type things before.
Yes.
There is a legend involving a certain Trudy. Could you revisit that one for us?
All right.
Supposedly, Warden's House might be haunted.
Well, maybe. If you believe in ghosts, the Warden's House is haunted. And some people have come through who have very deep psychic, and they talk to them or they know them, and they came back and said that this female figure, the female spirit up there, is named Trudy. And of course, I was always sure, that's just dandy. But if you do the research, the last warden to live there was Warden Henry Wolfer. He had three sons and one daughter. The daughter's name was Gertrude. Known as Trudy. And Gertrude got married, moved down to Blue Earth, Minnesota, and she had a child. 8 months after the child was born, she died of a burst appendicitis, And she was...
Trudy or the child?
Trudy.
Trudy, okay, the mother.
Then Trudy was brought back to Stillwater to be buried. The son was brought back. The baby, the 8-month-old baby, was brought back to live with his grandfather in the warden's house until the grandfather retired as warden in 1914 and moved out to California. And supposedly, people tell me that Trudy is there fussing over her young son because that's where he went after she passed away. Now, sure, could be.
Does she cause problems, or is she just whining?
No, she does help. I wish she'd do a little better in the cleaning aspect, supposedly...
Well, that's where your office is, isn't it?
She's upstairs.
But I mean, you're in the house, aren't you?
Well, I used to be, but I'm up in the carriage house, where, by the way, we also have a ghost of an old trustee who was supposedly taking care of the horses up by the carriage house. And he's still around trying to take care of the horses.
Trustee would be a prisoner. An inmate,
first grade prisoner who had, could go outside the walls and help with other type of things. And he was supposedly outside the walls taking care of the horses. And we have one other ghost, another trustee down in the basement shoveling coal. I don't know, if you were a ghost, would you choose to shovel coal for the rest of eternity? I'm not sure.
I think I'd be up in the lounge having a glass of wine.
But
is that about it?
That's what
Brent Peterson, thank you. One more time. What's happening next Thursday here at Stillwater? The what, where, when, and how, please.
Water Street Inn. Fred Johnson speaking about the Sea Wing disaster. Thursday, September 25th, 5:30. You can call 439-5956 to reserve your spot. We need reservations. It's only $25 for non-members. If you're a great member like Mr. Turner here,
it's only
$20. It's benefit of membership. You can become a member that day. We will also have Fred's book for sale on site.
You'll have other books for sale.
Great books of the county of Stillwater. There's several good Stillwater books that are for sale.
A couple of which are by you.
That just happens to be true, but I don't brag or anything, but they will be there, and autographs could be had for a low amount of dollars.
You pay us to.
Exactly. I pay you so that I can sign it.
Brent Peterson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The top banana at the Washington County Historical Society, a guy who knows his history and makes it fun. Thank you so much, my friend, for all you do. Tommy, thank you.
My pleasure.
See you on Monday. Let's do some music. What do you say on
Monday?
Let's do it. All right, folks. Thank you for being with us. Hope you enjoyed the show. Have a great weekend, and we'll catch you noon Monday. Bye-bye.